This is Bristol. It's Friday, 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is the Lord Mayor of Bristol, otherwise known as Lib Dem Councillor for Brislington West, Joss Clark. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. Notable by their absence, as I said last week on this programme in the run-up to Brexit, I'm afraid this year have been all Bristol's MPs, four Labour and two Conservative, as well as the Labour Mayor of Bristol, Marvin Rees. Despite their refusals, I'll keep asking them, so let's hope they pluck up courage to answer some questions before the notorious date of Halloween. Actually, over the last week, I've had replies back from the Metro Mayor, Tim Bowles, and from Labour Mayor, Marvin Rees, to say neither of them wish to appear. Well, both of them paid quite a lot by us out of our taxpayers' money. One would have thought, Joss, maybe you could just comment on this, that they might like to just come and explain how Brexit might affect the city.
Absolutely. Bristol is going to be significantly affected by Brexit, and the more views that we get to hear, the better. And obviously, Marvin Rees, as Mayor of Bristol, has a significant role in the planning and the delivery of Brexit if it happens.
What's his line on Brexit? Do we know? If he was here, I'd ask him, say, well, what's going to happen, Marvin? Is it going to be a big disaster, or are we going to wake up the next morning and wonder what all the fuss was about?
City Council have been doing significant planning for Brexit, and I have to tell you, as a City Council, I've been getting regular emails with updates. So they are planning for
A no-deal Brexit.
They looks that way.
Okay.
They have to, don't they?
Also, before we get too far into actually discussing some of the issues of the week, what's your role as Lord Mayor been? What do you do as Lord Mayor? You're not sitting here with the gong and all your medals on this evening, but you have to do that from time to time, don't you?
I do. I wear two hats really these days. One is as Lord Mayor of Bristol, which means I'm the first citizen of the city, and my role is the ceremonial Lord Mayor, whereas Marvin's role is that of the political leader of the city.
Martin Summers, we've got three mayors, haven't we? We've got both Joss, Marvin, and we've got a Metro Mayor too.
Yeah, well, I was one of those that didn't think we should have elected mayors, and of course there's questions about whether we should have them, and I believe the Lib Dem position is that if you win the mayoral contest, that you're going to move to abolish the post.
Absolutely. That's our main sort of plank for the election, because we were never in favour of it as a we feel it takes away the democratic process of council, because it puts the power in one person. And with the arena debacle, that's a really good example of where the councillors were saying one thing and the directly elected mayor said something else. And
but the actual site that was going to be used for a Bristol arena, and there's some doubt over whether the city council should be financing an arena anyway. I mean, it's, you know, if it's not going to be commercially viable, surely a commercial company can do it. But that's been taken over by the university, so it's going to be surely used a lot more by young people, that space near Temple Meads, rather than as a commercial arena business.
Well, Bristol University, the plan has always been that they were going to come onto that site. So where the old sorting office was, that's where the academic buildings are, and the residential was always going to be on Arena Island. So that was always going to be going ahead, whether we had an arena or not.
OK, so how did the university manage to elbow the arena out of the way and take more space there?
Well, I don't think they have. They are continuing with their project as planned.
Is it still called Arena Island?
No, it's not. No, that's just me.
Okay. Listen, we are in the People's Republic of Stokes Croft studios this week because the programme couldn't come from Eastern Community Centre. BCFM on FM's programmes are resuming tomorrow morning with the breakfast show at 7 o'clock. And we hope to be back in Studio 2 at Eastern Community Centre at this time next week. I ought to really run through some of the things we're going to be doing in the second hour after 7 as well. The mysterious death in jail this week of key elite paedophile suspect and witness Jeffrey Epstein. obviously the story of the week, his intimate links to finance and sexual relationships of politicians, both sides of the Atlantic and beyond, as well as allegedly Israeli intelligence too. Stories of him attempting suicide and complaints by him in jail that someone was trying to kill him. So what really happened to Jeffrey Epstein and why? We'll be looking at that in an hour's time. And the US-China trade wars, surely counterproductive, and most worryingly with the potential to lead to a real fighting war between these two great nuclear-armed superpowers. This week we ask, with the help of US podcast Guns and Butter, how did the United States come to dominate the global economy, and how are China and Russia now undermining the prime position of the dollar? Well, there's some complicated arguments here, but if the truth were easily understood by children, I guess it would be on the BBC. And following on from last week's look at regulatory capture here in Britain by the global pharmaceutical giants, we return to the subject of GCMAF, or more precisely, phages. GCMAF is a cancer treatment said to boost the body's own immune system. That's phages, which are said to be one of the most natural and effective ways to fight cancer. But the production and sale of GCMAF, even though normal in Asia, New Zealand, Russia, and many countries, has been criminalised here in Britain. This week we hear from former Churchill Foundation fellow Grace Furby when she applied for a phage research grant to the Wellcome Foundation, one of these big pharmaceutical companies. She got short shrift. But she points out the Ministry of Defence most certainly do see enormous possibilities for phage treatment. Why might Wellcome and Big Pharma not want to research this kind of way of dealing with cancer? That's all in the second hour after the Comcast news at 7, or whatever news we can manage at 7 o'clock. On to our news review a bit more in a minute, though. But first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius and heavy rain this weekend. Highs around 20. That's warm, light cloud tomorrow. Wet and windy, though, on Sunday. So make the most of the weather tomorrow. Next week, highs of 18, sunny spells and showers through the week, some heavy, a bit like last week, that sounds. And next weekend, 24th and 25th of August, highs at around 20, that's hot again, sunshine and heavy showers next weekend. That's Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast for theweatheroutlook.com. Anyway, back to our news review, and I'm joined by the Lord Mayor of Bristol, and also she's a Lib Dem councillor for Brissington West, Joss Clark. Joss, I thought we'd start this week, though, by looking at a story which is... I think it's Tuesday it came out, and it's about High Street. It's saying that the retailers in Britain are saying they need some changes, particularly to business rates, and able to be compete with online firms. Otherwise, the High Streets are going to disappear. Now, many towns in this country, it's not just the retail parks. We're now in a situation where many businesses on the High Street simply can't make money. We're talking about maybe even large businesses here in Bristol, even in Cabot Circus, having to close. So what do you make of this appeal to change the law to make it so that actual High Street businesses are paying less business rate?
It's interesting you bring up this subject, because I went to a really interesting breakfast with Business West and Destination Bristol and lots of local businesses the other day. I went in the role of Lord Mayor, so I couldn't say anything at that with my Lord Mayor hat on. But it was really interesting to listen to them talking about the internet and the impact and the offer that shops need to make.
Well, this is the Amazons of this world, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. They had John Lewis were there, and they were talking a little bit about the impact of John Lewis moving out of Broadmead and their reasoning for doing that. The other thing that John Lewis talked about was how they're having to change their offer to become a kind of destination for an experience rather than just buying things.
Is the Bristol experience?
Within organisations, within shops, so they have to come and have Prosecco and try on clothes or whatever. So they need to kind of really think more laterally about it. In Brislington, we have an area of shops, and some of them are struggling a bit. But if you offer a decent product and you give good service, I do believe that people will use the shop.
But I mean, I can get onto my phone and I can order something, yeah. It will turn up next day and I don't even have to bother to go down the shop. Admittedly, you can't actually sort of touch it and feel it and have a good look at it before you buy it. But I mean, there are some checks and balances, aren't there, on online purchasing? So you can take it back. Some people offer free returns, all that sort of thing. It does seem to me that it's a bit of a no-brainer. At some point in the future, people are just going to have to forget retail, aren't they?
Well, they're also developing an app, I believe, where you can put in your picture, your face, and with all your body measurements, and you can try on the clothes virtually. I know, it's really scary. But actually,
it could be quite comic as well. See if you can get us the measurements of the mayor, and we'll try out various suits and things on him and various different outfits. Martin, this is a serious point, though, isn't it? The idea that actually the high street is yesterday's news and everything is now moving online. And what retailers are saying is they just can't compete.
Well, I mean, you're talking there about reducing their business rate, but the real problem is places like Amazon don't pay taxes because they're registered in all these tax havens and all the rest of it. And that's something that needs
Luxembourg,
to be addressed.
Luxembourg, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. And the other thing, of course, is that what's happening in the US is that all these malls that have been built, there's a lot of money tied up in building these malls, which were built, you know, some while ago. And of course, if they crash, that will be a trigger for crashing the whole economy. And then of course, nobody buys anything once you've crashed it, well, on internet or through retail.
So, I mean, what Joss is saying there is the idea that people go into a shop or whatever for an experience rather than to buy something.
Well, I think that's probably what's still keeping them in the game. But of course, the real problem is that they're paying their business rate based on whatever their turnover is. But the internet giants basically evade tax by the way they operate. And of course, if they were made to pay their taxes, they wouldn't be so competitive.
Well, you know what? It annoys me because it seems like there's no politicians who are actually prepared to come on the TV and really talk about this. I mean, I had a look around. It might be that some did and got under my radar, but I was trying to find, well, which politician has come up with a sensible response to this? And the answer was nobody. Why is that?
Well, I think one of the points you've just raised was around local authorities investing money in buying shopping centres. So in Western Supermare.
Oh, yes, the Sovereign Centre, I think it is, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Right. And the local authority have bought that. Well, it's
Marks, not the greatest time. Maybe.
Marks and Spencer's obviously have moved out of Western Supermare. Yeah. So it does beg the question, you know, that investment may have been a foolhardy one.
Well, yes, and maybe someone has just shoveled this load of rubbish investment, sorry, Sovereign Shopping Centre, onto the local council in Western.
That's right. I mean, the problem with this stuff is at a local level, there's not a lot you can do about these national and international trends. I mean, Amazon isn't just a national company, it's an international company. You know, so, and they use the fact that they're international to evade taxes, and they pay lousy wages, they don't
is
allow
it actually,
unions.
Is it actually fraud that they're doing? I mean, well, they were saying that each government is trying to get some tax off of them, and they say no, money's over here.
I hate to bring up the EU, but the EU are talking about, you know, because the EU is big enough to lock the internet giants out if they don't behave themselves. But individual countries like Britain are not big enough to do that. They'll just go somewhere else.
It's not just Britain. The EU have been talking about this for decades.
Yeah, well, it's very difficult to get anything to work because, of course, the advantages are all with the big corporations. Yeah, they're the ones who develop the technology, although they've got loads of help to do that. And then they're able to use their profits to get the best lawyers and all the rest of it to evade their responsibilities.
I am actually leading to something here. What do you make of the fact, alleged fact, alleged by me, that we saw very little response, if any response at all, from Britain's leading politicians on what they were going to do about the high street crisis this week?
Well, I think that there's quite a lot of head of steam about saying we're not happy with the way the internet companies operate. I think you'll find there's quite a lot of people saying that, and of course everybody wants to see, you know, there's all kinds of external benefits to having shops.
I mean, Martin, these tech giants are very good at lobbying, aren't they?
Well, they are. And of course, they make super profits because of the way things are set up, and they can use those super profits to then lobby government to carry on doing what they want to do. And it's very, you know, if you're the Federation of Small Businesses, even if you're all organised in one big organisation, you're basically in a different, you know, you're on a hide into nothing, aren't you? Mm.
I think what we're coming round to discuss now is something which I saw on on Channel 4 News this week, which was pretty shocking. And it is the former skills minister, that is a friend of Chris Skidmore, because it's Chris Skidmore from Kingswood, the Conservative MP. He was the, I think it was universities minister. This is the former skills minister, Nick Bowles, on Channel 4 News this week, discussing, because he resigned, and why he was asked how and why people get into politics, but particularly why they get into politics.
It's totally unpredictable.
Exciting.
You know, you ring on somebody's doorbell, they open the door, and you have 60 seconds, 90 seconds in which to engage them, which actually I usually think of as nothing to do with politics at all. You're trying to make them think that you're a nice guy.
But it sounds, I mean, when you were talking about the ring on the doorbell, it made me think about getting likes on a tweet or...
Yeah.
Because it's a confirmation, isn't it?
It's conducted almost entirely at an emotional level.
Yeah.
And you're trying to make somebody think, yes, I'd like to have a drink with that guy.
Seduce them.
And somebody wrote a fascinating piece about junk love and that Bill Clinton's appetite for junk love was closely related to his appetite for junk food. Mm. And that sort of an instant hit that you get from a Big Mac or a, you know, ice cream was not dissimilar to the instant hit he got from wowing a crowd. And I'm not immune to it.
So that's Nick Bowles there, former Conservative skills minister under David Cameron, with some absolutely amazing... I mean, I just was gobsmacked hearing him. It sounds like a kind of three-year-old, this idea of why I could get into politics. What do you make of it, Joss?
I think it's quite sad, actually, listening to that. It makes you feel really cynical, and anybody listening to that would feel really cynical about it.
It really was on Channel 4 News this week, right. Martin. I mean, he's saying, basically, I got into politics because I wanted to be able to knock on people's doors at random and I wanted them to think I was a nice guy.
Yeah, I don't suppose that's actually true. It's a presentation. It's a presentational trope that he's coming up with.
But he's also saying it's like being liked on Twitter or having a Facebook like.
He's trying to make it sound like he's down with the kids and he understands about these things.
But he's also saying, actually, for him, it was an emotional thing. He wanted to be acknowledged by people and to feel that he was being approved by people.
I imagine that is, I mean, that's obviously part of why people go into politics, but they've usually got things that they want to do. You know, that's really what makes people, they either want to protect the interests of corporations or build trade unions or whatever it is they want to do,
okay,
they want
so,
to do it.
So being there and standing up in public and the sensation you get from that is like eating a Big Mac.
Well, it's just silliness, isn't it?
It's crazy. Being in politics is not about the individual. It's not about me. As an individual, it's about what I can achieve for my residents and how I feel that I can make my residents' lives better and serve the city and serve the ward. I mean, it's not about you as an individual. I think that we do have politicians. Boris Johnson may be one of those who is about... all about ego and all about self, but I don't think that's what the job is really about.
Well, we had an interview with the former London Mayor Ken Livingstone on here a few weeks ago, saying that Boris saw himself as a celebrity and he wanted the celebrity status rather than to be an actual leader.
I think that's ludicrous. I mean, in politics is hard work. I mean, a lot of it is not glory. A lot of it is hard slog and doing some fairly mundane things about worrying about potholes and, you know, the bins being emptied. It's not about the sexy things in life at all.
Well, the other thing, of course, is that anybody involved in politics knows you come in for a lot of abuse.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like being a school teacher or something. You know, you're going to get lots of cheek and nastiness. And if you haven't got a thick skin, there's no point trying, you know.
And social media is absolutely prime territory for that. It really is. It's open season.
I wonder, though, whether some of these people who appear on social media are actually real people or whether there's, you know, some sort of political agenda. So if you're doing something quite challenging as a politician, you might suddenly find X number of bots start saying nasty things about you, because it's very difficult to actually figure out whether it's a genuine person. Have you ever been in that situation yourself, Joss?
Yeah, I have, and I'm always really dubious when people don't put pictures up, or they put pictures up of dogs and cats and things, because you don't see a real person, and it's quite difficult sometimes to work out whether these people are even in Bristol, let alone in my
area. What you sometimes get is someone looks like, it looks like this person is just a photograph from a clothes catalogue. You've really no idea what they're talking about. So let's have a look now at one of the reasons I thought I'd bring this up is because we've got all sorts of, well, Joanna Booth, who was on this programme last week, also did a, I thought, fascinating post. Other people won't agree, but it was about the city council's attendance record at meetings from 2015 to last year, just to give us an idea, because some councillors only make half the meetings.
Where
and
am
others
I?
And others go to all of them.
Where am I on that? Well, I dread to think.
I can't actually see. I think it was through a Freedom of Information request, Joss, that this was done. But no, I can't see you on here. So you're neither one of the very worst or the very best. But does it matter if you go to meetings? I mean, you're actually being paid as a councillor, aren't you, to do this?
I would think that I probably attend majority, if not all, the meetings I'm required to go to. In fact, I'd be surprised if I didn't. On that list, it'd be interesting to have a look at it. Yes, we have a duty to attend. We are actually required to do very little, in actual fact. We have to go to full council. If you're on scrutiny, you need to attend that, etc., etc. But those are very kind of, that's not a big commitment, really. I mean, obviously, you do many, many, many hours.
So how many is that, say, meetings a month? How many have you got to go to? Because, I mean, you're probably talking about half a day a meeting, is it?
Well, a full council, 8 times a year. Last one was 6 hours. And scrutiny would be about 6 of those a year. Don't quote me on that one. Yeah. And then you may have some task and finish, a couple of task and finish as well. But you may be on more than one scrutiny commission.
Wow, it's how long is a piece of string job, really, isn't it? Because you can get away with doing very little. Anyway, let's have a look at some of the results of her Freedom of Information request. And I'll put a link up to this article on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So we'll start with the best, and that is someone called Steve Smith.
Oh, right.
I think he's the new guy, on the Conservative Westbury. For Westbury on Trim. Yep. And actually, it's a bit of a cheat because he hasn't had quite so many meetings to attend.
No.
100% he managed, allegedly. Then we've got, again, for the Conservatives, at number 2 of all the best is John Goulandris from Stoke Bishop. He refuses to come on this programme. We'd really like to talk to you, John, but he's another one like Marvin that won't come on. John is a Coutts banker, and I can remember sitting in the council chamber seeing him sitting on his app doing some sort of share trading when there was a meeting going on. So he's obviously into his trading shares. And the next down is Labour councillor Donald Alexander, then the Green leader Eleanor Cumley, Jeff Gollop, another Conservative, at 97%, 96%, Craig Cheney, Labour, Ollie Mead, 95%, Kai Dudd, also Labour, 94%, Stephen Clark for the Greens, who was on this programme recently, he's at 93%, and Tim Kent for the Lib Dems, another very good 93% of meetings they've been to. And of course, we're coming up to the end of the term, so this is it's a fairly good stretch, like over 4 years or so. And so, looking at the worst attendees, we've got 74%. That's only one. She'll miss one in every 4 meetings, roughly. Anna Keane, Labour. Mark Brain, Afzal Shah, Chris Davis as a Lib Dem, Lucy Whittle. Haven't managed to get her on here, I don't think. Sultan Khan, Paul Goggins at only 1 in 3 meetings he goes to. Only 2 in 3 meetings he goes to. Same with Kevin Quarterly. I think that's Quarterly, isn't it? And also Marge Hickman, the Labour leader. She only goes along to 2 in 3. But the worst, by quite a large margin, is 52%, is Hibak Jama, one of your people, Labour. In fact, it's 2 Labour people, Martin, who are the worst on the list.
Both Marge and Hibak are my councillors in Lawrence Hill. And the thing I'd say about this, if people don't like it, they can vote people out. I mean, that's the ultimate that's the ultimate thing about it. And of course, some people I mean, the councillors isn't just about meetings. And don't forget, if we've got an elected mayor, the councillors are basically redundant in going to meetings.
And over 4 years, it's a pretty good indication of someone's commitment.
I know there are personal reasons why Hibak hasn't gone to lots of meetings, which I don't particularly want to go into because it's personal to her. But the thing is also, as Joss will no doubt agree, lots of councillors do lots of things which aren't meetings. Meetings is very much just the icing on the cake. A lot of it is constituency work, dealing with individual cases. And of course, in a more deprived ward, you're going to have a lot more.
But as I've just pointed out, over 4 years, general attendance at meetings is a pretty good indication. Joss, what do you think? This is just a bit of fun, or is there something to this?
No, it's not a bit of fun at all. I mean, as we've just indicated. We don't have a lot of meetings these days that we're actually, you know, that our attendance is recorded.
Is it because councillors don't have much power? The mayor's got all the power and they think, well, what's the point?
I think that some councillors find it tricky because working, and if the meetings are in the day, then they've got to take time off work. Mm. So that can be, and I know that some councillors don't even work in Bristol, so that does actually cause some pressure. But we do have a duty to actually attend. You know, it is a duty.
Okay, so now we're going to go and have a look at another story from this week, which is, it's all around this Times newspaper sting, which came out in the Times on yesterday, on Thursday, about this organisation called Action Fraud. And on the midnight BBC News, I pricked my ears up because Action Fraud has been a bugbear of this programme for many years. We've been giving examples of people who have taken fraud cases to Action Fraud, which is a supposed national fraud organisation based in London. So basically, if you've got a fraud case and you go to the police with it, you can present your evidence to them. But most of the time, they will simply say, well, actually, we don't deal with fraud cases anymore here at Avon and Somerset Police. You have to contact this organisation called Action Fraud in London. And Julian Parry, who has passed away now, but back in 2014, he lived down in Weston-super-Mare, he spoke to me about the corruption, as he saw it, with the sell-off by Western Council of Knightstone Island. And here he is talking about his experience reporting this case to Action Fraud.
Local authorities seem to be sort of asset stripping stuff which has been built up by decades and maybe even a century old of generations, trying to make sure that people in the future, that the local authorities, that our common space is well looked after, that there's plenty of it, that there are lots of municipal buildings. This all seems now to be being asset stripped.
It's being asset stripped by individuals, not by the councils. It's individuals who hold high position in the councils and do things behind closed doors, and Knightstone Island is yet another example. Knightstone Island was sold effectively to Red Road Homes Southwest on the 24th of June 2005 in a lease, which the terms of which were a lease for 250 years, you won't get it back after the end of that, at £1 a year. The value of the site, if it had gone to auction, would have been about £8 million. Now, when we reported this to the police, local police commander Alex Cohen told me to go to Action Fraud. I went to Action Fraud a year ago, on the 8th of October. By the 10th of October, they had given it a crime number and it was being examined by national fraud experts. At about 11 o'clock on the morning of the 18th of October, the telephone rang and a voice said to me, "Action Fraud, sir." I said, "Good to hear from you. Your complaint of fraud." I said, "Yes." And he said, "Not fraud, sir." I said, "No, no, sir, not fraud. This is corruption. And we're dealing with it." "Absolutely splendid," I said. "I've got no problem with that. You call it what you will. I still think it's fraud, but up to you." And off he went. Of course, there has been no investigation. I have written to the Chief Constable twice to ask him what has happened about the investigation.
So that's Julian Parry, now sadly passed away. He was talking there to me in 2014 about the sell-off of Knightstone Island to Redrow Homes, who developed it. If you go down to Weston-super-Mare, that's a really nice place to live, lots of lovely flats there. But, Martin, we're talking about the difference here between a property, a very high value property owned by the council, which was £8 million roughly worth, and it was sold on a lease for 250 years to Redrow Homes for £1 a year. I mean, that doesn't sound like there's due diligence been done there, does it?
No, it doesn't. And the more we look into what goes on in that neck of the woods in Weston, the more you will find this sort of thing going on.
Hang on, it's not just there, is it?
No, it isn't. No.
Because we remember under Mayor Ferguson, the sell-off of the port here, for example, lots of public money seemed to be wasted there. But anyhow, what do you make of these sorts of cases, Joss? It's where it looks on the surface of it as if there's fraud of some sort going on, whether it's what the council benefiting Redrow Homes in that case down in Weston, and yet the police are reluctant to look into it.
I think it's really sad, and it's really regrettable that the police will not look into these things. One thing I will say that I've never experienced, and I have no experience at all of any fraud. I've never witnessed any within Bristol City Council. I've never come across it. That is just my experience.
But what about the business with the port? Because that was a lot of land. You weren't a councillor at that time. This is with Mayor George Ferguson. But anyhow, let's not dwell on that too much, because we're going to hear now from good old Noel Edmonds, because he has been awarded what they believe is a £5 million out-of-court settlement. He was arguing with the Castle Park branch of Lloyds Bank here, the business support unit of Lloyds Bank, about fraud. And he was threatening a private prosecution. He'd given a lot of information to the police. But anyway, Lloyds have finally settled with Noel Edmonds what is believed to be a settlement of about £5 million out of court. And here he is just a year or so ago talking to Afshan Rashani from Russia Today about the details of his dispute with Lloyds Bank.
With me is Noel Edmonds, the infamous British broadcaster. Noel, I was going to try and have a humorous...
Infamous?
Okay, famous. I was going to have a funny conversation with you, but you're outside Parliament, not because lots of MPs want to complain about Swap Shop.
No, I'm not having much of a laugh in there, but I've been meeting with Lord Cromwell, who is chair of the all-party group on fair banking, and he's showing a lot of interest in Lloyds Banking Group and the aftermath of the HBOS crime, which was described here in this very building as the worst banking crime in British history.
We'll obviously get people from Lloyds to respond to that, but these are the banks that were bailed out by the British taxpayer, and you believe that their actions were not the actions of a reputable institution.
Well, I don't think standing here is the appropriate time to go into the detail of all this, but the fact of the matter is six people went to prison in January, and Lloyds have apologised, they've admitted liability, and they put into place a compensation scheme. There are many people in that building and many of the victims who feel they are not conducting that scheme fairly, compassionately and swiftly. That's really what it's about. I'm not looking to create massive waves, but we do have a problem in the UK banking industry that needs to be looked at.
Why do you have faith in select committees, given that after the billions, hundreds of billions poured in to save the British banking industry at the expense of the taxpayer, very little scrutiny, many people believe, was applied by select committees in Parliament?
I think very little scrutiny was applied by almost any of those organisations that form part of what I call the regime. The regulators haven't been on the case. When we've got a situation where independent audits of banks are conducted by the very companies like KPMG, who make millions out of them, when you have an inquiry into a bank conducted by one of the big four city law firms who make zillions out of the banks, you can't talk about anything being independent. And that's one of the issues that we were talking about, and one of the things that we as a society need to look into. Do we want fair, honest, transparent banking? I suggest that millions of people who have suffered 10 years of austerity want that.
They've changed the names of the regulator, Financial Conduct Authority, so forth.
FSA,
And they would be the first to say, but we depend on people who have worked at the Big Five auditors and so on, and the Big Five legal companies, because they have the experience to understand what goes wrong. Therefore, we have to apply what you might accuse them of being the revolving door.
No, hang on. The truth of the matter is these people are employed because they know where the skeletons are. They know how to malpractice. They know how to get away with things without actually breaking the law. I mean, we have a banking system in this country where the proper people, the real people, are being sold financial products which then turn out to be inappropriate. I mean, think of PPI. And then the banks are fine. But they've already built that into their P&L. I mean, it's an extraordinary situation where they push the law. I mean, imagine you may have a driving licence and you would abide by the highway code. You don't go out each day and think, well, I'll keep breaking the law until I get caught. But that's how the bankers operate.
Yes, but the way you're talking sounds very similar to the way one hears Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell talk about banking practices. Do you think you're going to go and try and see this, the Shadow Chancellor is going to come up with something for you?
All right, I'll say something else on a political level, but please, you know, you stop me. I was walking through here doing something else, and we've latched onto this subject. The only reason I'm here is because my businesses were destroyed by Lloyds Banking Group, HBOS, and they went into administration, and we are now negotiating the compensation. It's the only reason I'm here. I'm not on some sort of great campaign. I'm not being Bob Geldof about...
But many other businesses are alleged to have been affected here.
Huge numbers of people. I mean, Lloyds have publicly said there's a £100 million compensation fund. I guarantee you it's going to be billions. When they went at the beginning of PPI, they said 90 million is the contingency. They're now in for 18 billion. They mislead, maybe not always knowing all the facts themselves, if we're being fair, but they're pretty bad at their forecast. But the other thing, which you won't broadcast, but I find astonishing, the aforementioned McDonald, and there's a fellow with a beard.
Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah. They could cream it into that place just up there. They would go in on the biggest tidal wave of public opinion if they said they were going to clean up the city. And instead, they make stupid comments about student loans and then don't fulfil the promises they made. If Corbyn said, I am going to clean up the city, he could wipe out the Tory party.
Bernie Sanders tried to say that in the United States, and it was the party protecting Wall Street, arguably Hillary Clinton, who tried to destroy Bernie Sanders.
I don't know anything about US politics, and as I've just shown, I know very little about UK politics. I'm just making the point, things need to be cleaned up. And you brought up the subject to Mr. McDonald, I didn't.
Okay, just very briefly, forget about deal or no deal, which is ahead
very
of my...
Very difficult to...
Ahead of my generation, but the critical... of critical importance, Swap Shop, in this time of austerity, surely you're going to present a comeback for that seminal television
program. I never go back. But I do admire you for one particular reason. And I don't know whether you're anticipating this, but I've never, ever met a broadcaster who matches his beard and his microphone.
Noel Edmonds, thank you.
Noel Edmonds there on the green outside the House of Lords. We should add that Lloyds Banking Group, for its part, says we are committed to doing everything we can to support those affected, and we are continuing to make good progress in getting offers to the victims of the fraud.
Yes, so that's Noel Edmonds speaking to Afsan Rashani a year or so ago. And the latest with Noel is that we hear after this settlement, out-of-court settlement with Lloyds, Martin, that he's plots a fresh legal assault on Lloyds Bank in the hope that more bankers are arrested. This is money on the 31st of July. Sources close to the TV star insist a compensation deal he struck with the bank does not mean his action against Lloyds is over. He was paid an estimated £5 million by Lloyds after bankers destroyed his firm. As part of the agreement, he's taken down a website criticising its boss, Antonio Horta Osorio.
Well, I think the idea that the banking system is full of fraud is pretty obvious, and nothing's been done about it. In the 1980s, when the savings and loans scandal broke in the US. 1,000 people in the US, top bankers, were sent to prison. In the 1930s, the Pecora Commission went through Wall Street like a dose of salts and sent loads of people to prison. Peter Galbraith, who is John Kenneth Galbraith's son, who's at the University of Austin in Texas, is an expert on this. He's saying, if you don't send people to prison, it's a green light for fraud. And of course, nobody apart from Bernie Madoff has been sent to prison, which shows that the fraud is still going on. And of course, we're going to find soon what happens with that when the banks collapse again, which is coming up very shortly.
And Joss, just finally on Noel Edmonds, Lloyds are saying they've got £8 billion set aside to pay compensation for fraud against people out of court settlements, but they're not going to pay a penny of it unless they absolutely have to.
You have to have the money to fight them, don't you? But it, I mean, if they've taken away your home and your business, you are in a really, really difficult position. So for the general public to actually be able to claw back their money is going to be a really tough job. And obviously, Lloyds aren't going to make it easy.
If you're an EU citizen living in the UK, you will need to apply to the EU Settlement Scheme. The scheme is fully open and you have plenty of time to apply. It is free, and all you need is your passport or ID card and to complete an online form. Support is available if you have any questions. To find out more and to apply, visit gov.uk/EU Settlement Scheme. Irish citizens or those with valid indefinite leave don't need to apply.
So we'll try and keep our Brexit chat brief this week. Yes, you could use all sorts of expletive words to talk about Brexit. Joss, what's your take on there's been a few developments this week. Apparently Jeremy Corbyn wants to be a caretaker. I suppose I don't know what kind of coat you have to wear to be a caretaker prime minister. One of those kind of old fashioned brownie grey coloured overcoats. And now some people in other parties have said, well, we don't want Jeremy Corbyn to be the caretaker prime minister. We'd rather it was either Harriet Harman or Ken Clark. So anyway, what do you make of all this? Do we need a caretaker prime minister? And is it actually, what's your prediction? What's going to happen?
Oh, you keep asking me this every time I come on the programme, and this has been rolling on for years, obviously, now. I would not like to speculate. Obviously, Boris Johnson is on a mission. I don't know. I honestly just don't know. I can understand why people have reservations about Jeremy Corbyn, and I would say that, wouldn't I? I think that a lot of people are still concerned that the Labour Party have really not resolved their issues, and they're still, I think, sitting on the fence about whether they want to remain or stay or what the deal should be. And they're just being a little bit too wishy-washy, and they haven't really nailed their colours to the mast. And I think that's where some of the concerns are.
So, Martin, Harriet Harman or even Ken Clark, apparently some of the right-wing Labour MPs would prefer him to Corbyn.
Well, I think that from my point of view, it's pretty obvious that the leader of the opposition, largest party, has got to be the first person that you think of as a caretaker prime minister. It would be foolish if he didn't put his name forward.
But it's no good if he hasn't got the support of the majority of MPs, is it?
If he hasn't got the support, I understand under the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which the Liberal Democrats helped to pass when they're in coalition with the Tories, which would already have a general election under the previous setup. But because we're now looking at the detail of the Fixed Term Parliament Act, but if the, as I understand it, the leader of the opposition will be called by the Queen to try and form a government if there is a vote of no confidence, and that will be the obvious thing. And if he can't form a government, then somebody else has a go. And then, but they have to wait. They get the second chance. Ken Clark or Harriet Harman or whatever gets the second bite of the cherry if Jeremy Corbyn, who is he's the official leader of the opposition in the House of Commons. The Queen's advice will be he's got to be given the first chance to form a government if there's a vote of no confidence in Boris Johnson. Now, he might not be able to form a government, in which case he's got to stand aside and let somebody else have a go.
Okay, that's enough for Brexit. Okay, that was quite quick, wasn't it? Back to fraud now and the Action Fraud story. And the guy that infiltrated Action Fraud in London, got a job there, is called Paul Morgan Bentley, bless him, from the Times newspaper.
The reason we went undercover at first at Action Fraud is we just kept seeing articles in other papers, in our own paper, from victims who were saying that they'd reported their very serious cases to Action Fraud and then they'd been abandoned with no explanation. We also saw some comments from former employees online talking about how the service was being mismanaged. So I applied for a job there, got the job. What we found was that there was a culture of mocking victims, of misleading victims, suggesting that their cases would be investigated when they knew they wouldn't. The managers there were mocking victims as morons, joking about them. A lot of the victims that call Action Fraud are very vulnerable. They would refer to them as psychos, as scroobles. And obviously that really shocked me, because you go into a call centre that's supposed to be helping victims of crime, and this is the language that scammers use. If this was just a couple of junior members of staff, the people making these comments were the managers. So, for instance, if you go onto the Times, you'll see our full footage. Most of the footage is of the trainer who is he's hired by Concentrix, the outsourced provider, to train every new employee that comes into work in the call centre. These are senior members of staff at Action Fraud.
And the person in charge of Action Fraud is not actually working, of course, at Action Fraud, because it's all been outsourced to this company called Concentrica, a US company. And that is Commander Karen Baxter of the City of London Police. She spoke to John Humphreys on the Today programme.
Let me apologise to victims and the public for having witnessed this footage. I am angry about it, and it is entirely unacceptable and will not be tolerated in any way. As soon as I was informed of this footage and of this information from Paul, I have very robustly had a number of meetings with Concentrix, our service providers. They have commenced urgently an investigation, and currently there are a number of staff subject to that investigation, and there are a number of staff suspended. I think that is entirely appropriate.
Wouldn't it have been more appropriate to sack Concentrix?
I think the first thing is that there is a degree of due diligence to be applied in this. But what I would like to reassure you is that when I look at this contract, when I look at the work, when I look at the standards going forward, all of those things will be scrutinised. I agree with Paul. When victims of fraud and economic crime phone Action Fraud, I expect them to be dealt with empathetically and that they are supported. Now, I think this is not endemic, and I would disagree with Paul that I know that Paul was there. I think you were there, Paul, for 6 days. I am told and I'm assured this morning that it is not endemic. However, he is right that there is one member of staff who's in a managerial role. That is not acceptable and will not be tolerated.
And he'll be fired.
I can't say that at the moment because that is a matter for Concentrix, the service provider. But what I can say is that that behaviour has no place in Action Fraud. It falls well below the standards of policing and well below the standards of the City of London.
But the reason I say he'll be fired, if he is not fired, I assume it's a he, by the way, it is, then Concentrix shouldn't be carrying out this job, should
I? Can assure you, John, and I'm conscious that we cannot talk about individual cases.
No, we've not named
that behaviour. And individuals who show that behaviour in Action Fraud and in that call centre, particularly in a managerial role, have no place in Action Fraud as we see it today. I will be doing a really stringent review around the standards. The one thing I would say is that actually Paul has done something for us that I perhaps could not have done in ways with the resources and the delivery of the service.
Well, that was going to be my question. Why didn't the police find out themselves what was going on?
So we are always aware that it's like being on a good day at school. So what Paul has done this morning and over the last few months is that in going in there undercover, it has provided what is effectively the secret shopper. So for that, I will take that information. We will scrutinise that and we will look at improving standards for the future.
But it goes beyond that, doesn't it? Professor David Cantor, one of the country's foremost criminal psychologists, he found Action Fraud to be completely useless. He'd had £18,000 stolen by scammers. While he was trying to reclaim the money, he discovered the UK bank account details of the fraudsters, tried to report them to Action Fraud. He was told by them they didn't want the information. His case would not be passed on to police. So there's something rotten at the core of this, isn't there?
So what I would say, John, is I'm not going to discuss individual cases. What we have in terms of fraud is that we have over 900,000 contacts in regard to fraud coming to Action Fraud every single year. Just under 300,000 of those end up being crimes. This is one of the fastest growing crime types that is affecting the United Kingdom. And what we need to do, not just in policing, not just in Action Fraud, but right across society, is decide how do we take this forward. We conduct an enormous amount of business with partners, with the National Economic Crime Centre, with business and banking. And what that is about trying to prevent it happening in the first place. We prevented £94 million of fraud last year with one of our units of the City of London. And I think that's where we need to get to. But it is unacceptable and I will not tolerate it going forward.
Commander Baxter and Paul Morgan Bentley, thank you both very much. And that story in The Times.
Yeah, so she's then going on to say, oh, I agree with him, but I'm not actually doing anything. Quite shocking. I'll put a full version of that interview up on our podcast at thisweek.org.uk. But actually, when she's apologising, this commander from the police there, she's saying, I apologise for this footage. She's not actually saying, I apologise for, you know, for people who will have seen this footage, I'm apologising. She's not actually apologising for what she's doing. Anyway, this does seem to be something to do with outsourcing here. Joss, and the City Council, we do quite a lot.
We do an awful lot of outsourcing these days, yeah, about monitoring and evaluating and making sure that due diligence is done before you take you actually give the contract to somebody should be done. And it's, if they're not doing the job properly and they're not being appropriate with their users, then actually they need to be held to account.
I mean, as a victim of fraud, as many people are, of course, and there's these phone scams, there's email scams and all sorts, you would hope that someone's going to take you seriously. But what we're hearing there is, oh no, these people are just psychos and morons, and this is what they're, and screwballs. And this is the sort of language that you'd expect from a fraudster, not from the police.
It's disgusting. It's just disgusting.
Martin, Concentrica are not, apparently have been asked by the City of London Police to investigate themselves over this.
Well, I mean, Centrica, another company, has also contracts a lot to local authorities. The whole idea of local authorities subcontracting and the police subcontracting out fraud investigations to private investigators, it just, you know, it's in a previous generation that would have been regarded as absurd. And that's where we're at.
So I spoke earlier this morning, actually, to an old friend of this programme, former Fraud Squad officer from the Met, Rowan Bosworth Davis. He's also the author of a book called Fraud in the City, Too Good to Be True. And he wrote that in 1988. But he also said that after the Blue Arrow trial in 1992 and 1993, when some very powerful blue blood bankers got off, and it was a case that he was partly involved in, the message went out across the fraud squad in central London that there will be no more prosecutions of these very powerful bankers. So this is what Rowan Bosworth Davis had to say about this case to me earlier today.
At a time when there was great public concern about fraud and fraud management, and what the architects of this thing did was to forget that they forgot the underlying nature of fraud, which is that somebody is deceived, and that the whole basis of that word means that someone's mind has been altered by a lie or some form of untruth. So when people are deceived, you know, the people on these phones just laughing at them and saying, oh, what a fool you are, and what, you know, calling them idiots and, you know, all the rest of it. But that is the very essence of the fraudsman's skill, is that he actually deceives people so that they act upon his lies. So rather than sneering at people, fraud victims are, in many, many respects, to be pitied. Therefore, if that is the case, and if the government's got ambitions to allow people to be responsible for their own investments and be responsible for their own future financial well-being, in my book, they have a duty to ensure that where wrongdoing is carried out, there is a means of investigation and redress. And when we live in a world as we do now where there are so many different methods of obtaining access to you and my personal information and personal data, it seems to me that the requirement to help to control wrongdoing is greater. And this has clearly failed. I mean, I remember with bitterness, real bitterness, all the sneers that were cast against the actions and the conduct of fraud squads in this country. And as an ex-fraud squad officer, I would feel very strongly about it. But the fact of the matter was, no sooner did they set up this vast edifice to do all these fraud investigations, then before you knew where you were, they were outsourcing the very front line agency that exists to sit between the criminal and the legal process. And it's outsourced to, I mean, the most lowly paid people earning most of minimum wage. What do they expect them to do? They suddenly expect them all to become Sherlock Holmes and to actually do the job properly, or are they just going to sit on the end of the phone, do their 8 hours and go home?
Sometimes when people lose money, the organisation itself will say, well, sorry, that's just tough luck. And others will say, well, this is fraud.
Yeah,
because
that's why on the telephones you need people who understand the problem, who know how to tell the difference between what is fraudulent activity and what is just bad luck or bad judgment. My reading of this story is that the people they were employing to do this work were getting minimalist training, and in fact, when they had to take a test as part of their qualification process, the answers were written on the wall. So, if you haven't got people who know the difference between and you can take it from me that sometimes the distinction between fraud and bad luck is cigarette paper thin. You have to have a really good understanding of what is potentially fraudulent and what is not fraudulent to be able to make the judgment call as to whether or not to investigate or to, unfortunately, put the thing to bed. But more importantly, and this is the other thing that infuriates me about this action fraud thing, is that every single one of these allegations that's come in and has just been recorded and then obviously clearly then just shredded or, you know, put in some dark, deep hole somewhere, never to see the light of day again. What those people are missing is that all criminal investigation, particularly criminal investigation that deals with allegations of crime that have patterns and have serials of activity, you actually need the details of all those allegations, even where you don't necessarily find sufficient evidence to be able to prosecute. You still need the details of that conduct, because you will find that once you start to analyse the behaviour, you'll start to see patterns emerging. And it's when you start seeing those patterns emerging that you can actually, because this is an intelligence gathering exercise, and when you see those patterns emerging, you can then talk to your investigators and say, you know, look, we're looking at a new methodology appearing here. Because the criminals are always one jump ahead. They're always coming up with new scams and schemes and methods to defraud the public. I mean, look at the fraudulent practice that's been going on with private pension schemes and privately administered pensions. And I'll tell you another one that's out there, and it's a scam in waiting, and that's all this equity release, old people being encouraged to engage in equity release schemes. Every single day, there are adverts appearing on Facebook to, you know, engage in equity release. And that's another rip-off in waiting, in my opinion. The criminals do these things because it's easy to get away with. But one of the things that I always cleave to, if you want to disincentivise criminals from engaging in certain kinds of conduct, what you have to do is you have to make it a very high degree of probability that they're going to get caught. The greatest disincentive to crime is the likelihood of being caught. And the only way we're going to do that in our society is to put systems and controls in place that make it very, very hard for these people to engage in this kind of behaviour and get away with it. The only problem there is that we're up against, as you are in all capitalist societies, you're up against, there's a complete conflict of interest between the interests of the investor on the one hand, to invest in a safe environment, but at the same time to accept the risks of these products can go up as well as down and all those other things, as opposed to the interests of the banks and the financial institutions whose interests are to get as much money out of your pocket as they possibly can in the shortest possible time. So there's always going to be a major conflict of interest. And I mean, I don't want to be seen to be pointing the finger at police and saying, you did a bad job, you did a good job, whatever. That's not my business. But what I am concerned about, I start from the premise that the moment you start outsourcing any form of regulatory administration and you outsource it to an agency that has to make money out of its contract, you are going to end up on the line of least resistance. It doesn't matter what it is, you're going to end up on the line of least resistance. So they will always employ people who, well, frankly, people who can't get jobs elsewhere. It's a dreadful indictment of the process. Once you start outsourcing these important regulatory controls to agencies that have no skin in the game, have no interest in ensuring that there's any kind of successful outcome, you're hiding to nothing.
And that's Rowan Bosworth Davis, former Fraud Squad officer there, and he's the author of a book, Fraud in the City, Too Good to Be True. Martin, it does seem that the fraud now is something that's actually being facilitated by Action Fraud, potentially, as they simply do not investigate things. That actually helps quite a lot of people, doesn't it? Fraudsters.
If you think back to the crisis in 2008, a decision was taken that if they were going to prosecute anybody, they'd have to prosecute everybody, and they weren't going to prosecute everybody, so they didn't prosecute anybody. And in actual fact, a lot of the top people of the top banks should have been sent to prison and their assets
should have
been
seized. So what you're saying, actually, the biggest fraud of the lot happened in 2008.
Well, what happened at that point is fraud becomes, if you allow fraud, if people who have got a bottom line every quarter to their bosses, they've got to engage in fraud as well. If other people are doing it, you've got to do it. And if you don't stop it, it becomes endemic. And it is endemic. The banks are insolvent and run by fraudsters.
Sounds like a bit of a virus, Joss. I know it's a bit of a deep one, this, but what Rowan's saying there is potentially the next load of fraud will be coming as people do this equity release scheme, and this is really a bonanza for the fraudsters, and it doesn't sound like Action Fraud are quite up to the job.
I have real reservations about equity release. It's a really expensive way of borrowing money, and it means that families are not going to have any equity in the property when it's actually finally sold, and I just think it's a real shame because the setup costs are really high.
Final story, I think it will be the final story anyway this week, is from the Bristol Post this week. Bristol could end up with a congestion zone to charge drivers. Well, we know this, but what's the latest on this, Joss? Apparently, Marvin Rees, the mayor, says he doesn't want this to be charging drivers. So what's going to happen? What's your take on it?
We've obviously just finished the consultation, and we will have to see what the comes out from the consultation. And my reservation about a lot of these things is about the push and the pull. I believe that we should be encouraging people to get out of their cars by providing good quality public transport.
So what about turning all the central Bristol roads into bus lanes so cars aren't allowed there? That seems to be one of the things that, you know, there seems to be more and more bus priority and less ability for cars to get around.
Yeah, and the spatial strategy has got an awful lot of infrastructure.
Now, the mayor is the elected leader of this city.
We've got an awful lot of infrastructure changes within the spatial strategy if it does come forward, and buses will have a huge priority. But what we do need to do is we need to encourage people out of their cars, not push them out of their cars and make it so difficult or so expensive for them that they actually resent it. And we actually want them to want to get out of their cars and get onto public transport.
Martin, congestion charge, are we going to have it here? What do you make of all this? I mean, you probably don't know whether we're going to have one.
Obviously, I'm not
one
counselor.
Of the things that has annoyed me is that my diesel's got a wonderful particulate filter on it, and apparently this doesn't make any difference at all. It's still a dirty diesel just like any other one. Isn't it? This is just a way of the council just making revenue out of this, isn't it? Another tax.
We were talking about councils selling off stuff in Western Supermare. Councils are attempting to keep frontline services going by all sorts of scams. And that's one of the problems. They haven't got the resources to do what they need to do, so they then try and find other ways to do it. That's where the public interest goes by the way.
Well, we're trying to get a bit of news for you at 7 o'clock, but so if it appears, it will probably just push us out of the way. Final comment from you, Joss. Your thoughts about this whole business of fraud. Why is it that the police and why is it that the authorities are not taken seriously? Because it is part of your responsibility as a councillor, because the local authority, we fund Avon and Somerset Police to look after all this stuff for us, to make sure these scamsters are not getting away with it. But it seems that they are now saying, oh, well, it's nothing really to do with us fraud anymore, and they're kind of shirking the issue.
I think you need to have somebody else to have a conversation on this programme about just that. And the Police and Crime Commissioner might just be that person.
She might. She's already been pressed quite a lot on it. Anyway, I think it's time to wrap up this first hour.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity run entirely by volunteers. That means we are not for profit, so we can put you, the people of Bristol, first. BCFM 93.2. The station you can count on.